I'm really glad that's the version of that story you told.
She might have had some other words that would have been less encouraging. I have that one line is, if a man says something in the woods and there's nobody around to hear it, is he still wrong? That's one of my favorites. But I appreciate you being here today. It's great to be back. I hadn't realized how long it had been. I hope you all get to meet Cynthia. She's been my salvation after losing my wife of 49 years. And she's put up with a lot, continues to, as I'm sure you can imagine. I do hope you'll take time to look at the displays around the room. We didn't just redecorate your auditorium for no reason here. It's important for you to know what your kids, what your grandkids are facing, what the world today is about. I have a fossil display up here. We'll be talking about that Wednesday night. I hope you'll take time to look at it. All of the dinosaur fossil remain pictures around the room. And these are all public school posters that your kids are, for the most part, very well familiar with. I have an atheist display over here to your right. And those are all posters that are on college campuses, in high school auditoriums, and libraries. I have a display of atheist magazines up here. A lot of adults don't even realize what the magazines are, much less their quality, and much less the fact that they're in virtually every high school auditorium and library in the country. And it's important to realize the type of challenges kids are facing today. So this morning, I want to talk a little bit about the new atheism. It's a new age. And the church has not responded well to the new age. You know, we're all worried about internal problems. We're looking at ourselves, what we like, what we don't like, instead of looking at what our kids are facing, what our grandkids are facing. And the result is we're losing a fantastic number of them. This advertisement's been all over the country. Look at the basic of it. Don't believe in God? You're not alone. They go on in their advertising and point out that 43 million Americans, 43 million, indicate they have no belief in God. They're non-religious. A recent Gallup poll asked Americans, what do you believe about God? What is your faith? 40%, you hear that number? 40% of the people in the United States said, none. None. And if you think that number's right, just think on your way here today, how many people you went by on the highway were going to church? What percentage? And in the young people, it's vastly larger than that. So there's a challenge facing us today. And the atheists are using a major campaign, especially on the web. It's also in printed material, but a lot of these quotes are taken from the web. And I want you to notice as you read these quotes that these aren't rinky-dinks. These are well-known people, well-known political figures, sports figures, people who have a strong reputation, people who are recognized in the scientific and literature communities. Weinberg's a Nobel Prize winner. So he carries a lot of weight. And he can make the case. Sam Harris, major bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. What that means is they've sold over 1 million copies of it. It's now gone over 5 million. But notice the message. And by the way, it isn't hard to believe what these folks are saying. I mean, how many people were killed in the name of Allah in the last 24 hours? How much warfare is going on between religious factions, not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in St. Louis? You don't have to go far to see the conflicts and to see the problems that are involved. So a lot of people are saying, we just need to get rid of religion, period. There's even a bill right now being pushed into Congress that makes it illegal for churches of any kind to have tax-exempt status. Can you imagine what that would do, for instance, to the Roman Catholic Church in this country that has millions and millions and millions of acres? All kinds of businesses. The fact, for instance, that the Mormon Church owns Eastman Kodak, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. Imagine the impact. And young people are pushed with statements like this. I want to come back to this in a minute because I think it's an interesting tool we can use. But I think when you start looking at statements like this and talking about what young people are being exposed to as far as what the nature of God is, one of the things you have to ask in the discussion is, where are they coming by this? Where is all this information coming from? Folks, this is a quote from Rivers Out of Eden, a required reading course in all basic philosophy courses that are credited by the American Humanist Association. And as you read through it, and we'll see it a couple of more times throughout the week, look at the message. The universe we have, precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's an appealing message to a lot of people. And I think it's important to understand this starts early. This is an eighth grade general science book used widely in the state of Texas. Has your eighth grader been equipped to deal with this? You know, 1 Peter 3:15 says, be ready to give an answer of the reason of the hope that is within into every person. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not doing that. We're not giving answers to these kinds of challenges. And the result is we have kids and grandkids that have totally lost their faith simply because we are not addressing the needs that they have. And by the way, there are all kinds of reasons for this. You're going to see me go pretty fast here, both sessions this morning, because time is an issue. But I can give you proof that that statement is not a scientific statement that he is making. So here are your major bestsellers, except for the last one. I'll mention that in just a minute. All of these books are on the web. All of these books have achieved New York Times bestseller status. So they're recognized as having sold millions and millions of copies. And look at the bottom one. There's a website kids can go to and blaspheme God. They can commit the unforgivable sin. And I'm putting that in quotes because if you know your scripture, what they're talking about here is not what the unforgivable sin is. But we won't go there right now. The point is they're asked to blaspheme God, cuss at God. So as you look at the statements these kids make, they're full of four-letter words. One kid used the F word 65 times in his statement against God. And that's an eighth grader. An eighth grader. So I say, well, okay, that's an extreme thing. Nobody's doing that. That's just, they have over 685,000 posts on that site right now. So 685,000 people have taken the blasphemy challenge and have done what they think is blaspheming God an unforgivable sin. It's extremely successful. And they use quotes that you may find unbelievable. Hector Avalos is a well-known atheist. He's a philosophy professor. He posted this, and when I read that thing, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Hitler didn't do that. So I went back to the source. And as a matter of fact, Hitler did do that. Kids can go to this site and they can read what Hitler said. And of course, as you can see, it's anti-Semitic. You can see the nature of it. You can see the bad theology involved. But nonetheless, it's a quote which a lot of people will read and attribute to Christianity. So as you hear me going through these things and you ask, you know, you deal with these things, you say, well, okay, that's all out there, but it's not doing anything. Folks, that just isn't true. A recent Gallup poll showed that 25% of all people going in and out of church buildings, what they call Catholics and Protestants here, were people leaving the structure. Okay? So we're talking about people walking out of the Catholic Church, walking out of the Church of Christ, walking out of the Methodist Church, out on the doorsteps. They're asking them, do you doubt God's existence? These are the people going to church. And 25% say, yeah, I'm not so sure. It's effective. People have doubts. And it may be socially acceptable in the past, to say I'm a Christian. It's not anymore. Do you know that Christianity is a minority religion in the United States today? I'm not talking about New Testament Christianity. I'm talking about people who have any kind of belief in Christ. Less than 50% of our population says, yeah, I believe in Jesus. That's including everybody, Methodists, Presbyterians, Protestants, Jehovah's Witnesses, etc. So it's extremely effective. So what are the weaknesses? How do we attack this? Well, I think that's one of the places we need to start. Some of you may not know this, but this congregation has been helping me in my ministry now for a long time. Way before 2003, we were working together. We did some radio programs together in San Antonio. And so we've been at this a long, long time. What we've tried to do is to take the things that atheists use and try to show people why they are not valid. All right, let's do an example here. This is a quote from Richard Dawkins. He's the number one atheist in the world, recognized with that title, very well-educated man. Professor at Oxford, has extremely advanced degrees. He's got a wonderful knowledge of biology, a very poor knowledge of the Bible. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. One of his fellow professors at Oxford wrote a book called, named Alistair McGrath, wrote a book called The Dawkins Delusion, which actually was so good that Michael Ruse, who's one of the leading atheists in America, said that Dawkins made him embarrassed to be an atheist. Okay, why would he make that statement? And why am I making those kinds of statements about Dawkins' weaknesses? Well, let's take a look at this. I want to do just maybe three examples. We don't have much time, so I'm going to fly through them pretty quickly here. But arguably the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. All right, there's the starting point. He's claiming the Bible is fiction. God is jealous and proud of it. Okay, folks, are there any passages in the Bible that says that God is a jealous God? Yeah. And Dawkins quotes those passages. I have them up there on the screen. So yeah, the Bible says God is a jealous God. Okay. What kind of jealousy is this? Is this the kind of jealousy I have? I see my friend here has a really nice car and I don't have a nice car, so I'm jealous? Is that what it means? You know, it's kind of interesting to understand the nature of jealousy. There's two kinds of jealousies. One kind of jealousy is the kind I just talked about. He's got a better car than I do. I'm jealous. And then there's the tougher kind of jealousy. The jealousy of heartbreak. I'm a very fortunate man. I've been married to two different women who both have high moral standards. So I know nothing about what I'm talking about right now from personal experience. But some of you have had a situation where your mate, the person you gave yourself to, the person who was your soulmate, was unfaithful to you. I can't imagine how much that must hurt. I just can't visualize that. I've had a lot of things in my life that are kind of rough, but I've never had anything like that. I can't imagine how painful that would be. Infidelity. Someone you gave everything to. Someone you trusted suddenly turns to someone else. I can't comprehend it. And that's the kind of jealousy that God talks about when he says in his passages, I am a jealous God. God gave Israel everything. You read Deuteronomy 28 and look at what God said to them. How he gave them recognition, how they gave them natural resources. Our Creator, the God who took care of Israel, who nurtured Israel, did everything for Israel. And then Israel turned around and left God and embraced a pagan god, Baal, of the people around them. And God says, you're breaking my heart. I'm a jealous God. See, that's not what Dawkins is conveying. He completely misrepresents the biblical concept of God by composing God as a God that is like a little kid that somebody has a toy that they don't have. And that's not the nature of jealousy that God's talking about. Now, we need to help kids understand that. When God is a jealous God, it's the same kind of jealousy that we experience on a very small scale when we have enormous heartbreak. Let me give you another example. Dawkins says, well, okay, God is a God who is an ethnic cleanser. And so he goes to 1 Samuel 15:3. God is talking about the Amalekites here. The Amalekites. And he says to Israel, okay, we're going to get the Amalekites. And Israel, here's what you're to do. You're to go into that Amalekite kingdom and you kill every man, woman, baby, and animal. And then you set the place on fire and burn it to the ground. And Dawkins sits back and says, you talk about ethnic cleansing. There's not a civilized person on the planet of Earth today that would sanction doing something like that. God is an ethnic cleanser. Well, that could sound pretty convincing, couldn't it? You know, if you're honest and you're a kid who doesn't know the Bible and you hear that and you read the passage, but if you go back in the passage and if you look at our secular knowledge, you get a whole different picture. Because this Amalekite kingdom was a group of people who participated in sexual acts as part of their worship. Promiscuity was held up as a virtue. The result of that was rampant promiscuity in the culture. Their dietary rules were non-existent. They drank raw blood. And it was especially considered to be a wonderful drink if it was the blood of a human. They were involved in eating anything that they wanted to. And the result of this was that every sexually transmitted disease we know today was present in the culture. Now, if you know anything about sexually transmitted diseases, STDs are not just in the participants, are they? They're in the babies. Do you know that 87% of all viruses that cause illness in humans today were contracted from animals? 87%. And there's doubts about the remaining 13%. So what does that mean? Well, if they're having sexual acts with animals, which they were, the diseases are in the population. Matter of fact, massive numbers of our STDs came from sheep to humans. And also from animals to from monkeys to humans in that same transmission technique. What's interesting about that is that when we dig up the bones of the Amalekites and the people around them, we see every indicator of every STD we know to be present today. So how do you solve that? You know, right now we have a thing going on in Africa. And I'm not going to talk about Ebola right now, although there's evidence Ebola is in the same category. But AIDS in Africa has been transmitted mostly from animals into humans. You may not know this, but chimpanzees can carry the AIDS virus without having any of the symptoms. And there are people in Africa using chimpanzees as sex tools. So what's the result? AIDS is rampant in the culture. As a matter of fact, we've moved in there with every technology we know today to combat HIV, and we are being totally unsuccessful. Why? The health workers say, until you change the moral beliefs of the culture, you're not going to solve the disease problem. And that is exactly right. So how would you do it with the Amalekites? I suggest to you, God had no choice. He had to sterilize the area. Unpleasant as it was, everything had to be consumed by fire, or the diseases would have continued to run rampant. That's not ethnic cleansing. That's a hygiene problem, a result of failing to follow solid, basic hygienic principles. Let me show you one more example. Dawkins says, well, God is just a petty, vindictive God. And to back that up, he goes to the story of Uzzah in 2 Samuel 6, beginning with verse 1. Remember that story? The Israelites are bringing the Ark of the Covenant back. They haven't had it for a long time, and they're returning it to its rightful place. So they put it on a cart, and they're wheeling it back to its rightful place. And as the oxen are pulling the cart hits a pothole, and it tips. And a man named Uzzah, who is walking beside the cart, reaches out and catches it to keep it from falling off the cart. And God strikes him dead on the spot. And Dawkins says, well, how can you believe in a God that is petty? I mean, for crying out loud, all he was trying to do was stop the thing from falling on the ground. That's a vindictive act of a petty God. How can you believe in a God like that? I hope you're open-minded to think through that. Can you put yourself back into being a 10-year-old kid and hearing that argument? I mean, that makes sense. But what is the case here? Well, go back and read Exodus 25, starting with verse 10, and read about the view of what carts were for and what kings were carried by. You see, in that culture, a king was carried on the shoulders of humans. Why? Because it indicated their status. And it also allowed them to go over uneven ground. And if you read the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, it was specifically designed with loopholes to put poles through so it could be carried by the proper number of men so that the king would never have to worry about potholes or any kind of other obstruction in the process. Kings were carried on the shoulders of men. What were carts for? Carts were for baggage. Carts were for garbage. Read the passage. The junk you didn't care about was put on carts. Number 7, beginning with verse 3, is a complete description of that. Not only that, but God specifically told the Israelites, if you touch the ark, you will die. Read it. Numbers 4, verse 15. I'm a high school science teacher. I'm not a preacher. That's probably already obvious. When I was working in physics and chemistry, I used to take a summer seminar in nuclear energy at the nuclear facility, Argonne, in Chicago. In the process of our training, they had samples that they were doing experiments with of radioactive materials. One of them was a sample of plutonium. It had a sign on it that said, do not touch this container or you will be irradiated. How many times do you think I touched that container? How many times do you think I got anywhere near that container? If the container fell off the cart, what would you guess I would do? Run! I'm going to stand there and catch that stupid reactor. And in this case, God says, don't touch it or you'll die. And what happened to Uzzah was a fulfillment of what God said was going to happen. This is not vindictive. This is not some kind of a petty act. They insulted God. They said, God, you're just baggage. And they put guard on the cart. Well, we've sort of done that too, haven't we? In our culture today, God's not very important to a lot of people. We put him on the cart. And you wonder how long it'll be before he'll strike us down. But it's important to understand that all of these examples, and we could go through the rest of them, all of the examples of what Dawkins says is a property of God is easily disproven. Young ladies, Dawkins says God is misogynistic. In other words, he hates women. Let me ask you something. What rights do you have today as a woman compared to what you would have had before the time of Christ? You know, before the time of Jesus, a man always walked 15 feet in front of his wife. If she got closer than 15 feet to him, she was in trouble. And if she walked beside him, she was dead. That was the role of women at the time that Jesus lived. And one of the complaints people had about Jesus was that he was associated with women and that they were an integral part of the work of the early church. You see Jesus in a completely different light. What I'm saying to you is a wonderful Bible class for young people today is to take Usher's, or take Dawkins' statement and one by one go through it and show he says exactly the opposite of what God's Word says and what God is really all about. The next point I want to make here is that atheists like to take passages and pull them out of context. We've already seen some of that. And they try to turn God into a human. I think it's Tuesday night. Our lesson here is going to be, what is God? As far as I'm concerned, it's the most important lesson in the series. Not who is God, what is God? Is that your concept of God? Is God an old man in the sky with long white beards and big white flowing robes? I have a little booklet up here which is titled, Why I Left Atheism. If you're not familiar with me, this is my personal story. If you'd like a copy, come up and help yourself after class here in a few minutes. But you see, when I grew up, God was a man. And the arguments I used as an atheist were arguments centered around my belief that God was a man. So I would ask questions like, how can God hear my prayer and the prayer of a little boy in China at the same time? I would ask, what sex is God? I would ask, who created God? I had all of these questions which were the result of my turning God into a human. And this happens over and over and over again. Look at this. This is a poster. I blacked out a particularly offensive part of it. But it's claiming that God is a sexually manipulative God. And it's on every college campus in the country. What's the concept? A misconception of what God is. I'd also like to call your attention to the fact that they don't deal with the real question. You know, it interests me that atheists want to talk about the Bible. They want to talk about the Bible. Why do you think this passage says what it says? Why does the Bible say this and so? Hey, if there is no God, then why are we talking about the Bible? Let's talk about the evidence there is a God. Tonight, we're going to start that. Tonight, I want to make a cosmological argument that's based on science. I can prove to you that God exists. I won't answer the question of which God. We'll do that later. But the question is, what is the evidence there is a God? Can we look at the cosmos, the expanding universe? Can we prove it had a beginning? The answer is yes. Can we prove it was caused? The answer is yes. One of the interesting things that's happened recently is there's a guy that wrote a book proving that you can create something out of nothing. It's a famous book. Atheists are promoting it all over the place. He's gotten all kinds of recognition. How does he do that? He does it by redefining nothing. What does the word nothing mean to you? Hey, you want something fun? Go on the web and do a word search on nothing. There are over 1.5 million websites dedicated to nothing. We have learned all there is to know about nothing. So we know more and more about less and less until we know absolutely everything about nothing. See, what they do is they define nothing as the absence of matter. The absence of matter. So they say, okay, if you put matter and you put it together with antimatter, matter plus antimatter destroys each other, producing nothing. No. That's not true. Did you ever hear of E equals MC squared? It doesn't produce nothing. It produces energy. And energy can be turned back into matter. We've actually done that now. So the book is built on a complete misrepresentation. It's a fraud because they have simply redefined the term. But our kids are reading a book by a well-known reputable scientist who says he has proved that something can come from nothing. Listen, Stephen Hawking is a brilliant man, and I admire his battle with ALS. And he has some wonderful things that he has presented to the scientific community. But he is not a god, and he has made tons of mistakes, and this is one of them. Don't put your faith in any human. And then the other question here is the question of theology. My basic message that I'm presenting every weekend that I speak, and I speak about every weekend, one way or another, is that science and faith are not enemies. They're not like that. And if you're a Christian, you know that's true. If God created the creation and told us what he did in his word, and if in fact God is the creator, then the written word and the creation came from the same author and they can't possibly conflict. If they conflict, it's because we either have bad science or bad theology or both. And the lesson of history has been there's been a ton of both. Science and faith are friends. They support each other. They reinforce each other. Let me tell you why I'm in this ministry, what tipped me over to start doing this back in 1968. I had a kid in one of my first physics classes, one of my AP classes at Riley High School, where I taught for 41 years. The kid was a preacher's kid, Baptist preacher's kid. And he was a good student. He was a brilliant, just incredible mind. And I had so much fun with him in class because he was so sharp. As a matter of fact, we were doing those motion problems you do in the first couple of weeks of a physics class. And we were using algebra and even starting to do a little trig. And he came in and he said, "You know, this is so slow. Isn't there a better mathematics than this?" I said, "Well, yeah, that's why Newton invented the calculus." He said, "Really? Tell me." I said, "Here," I gave him my calculus book. The next homework assignment, he was using differential calculus. 2 weeks later, he was using integral calculus. By the end of the semester, he was doing partial derivatives. And I happened to go back and review because I forgot all that stuff. Brilliant, brilliant. But the end of the year, he comes in. And his school class is over and says, "You know, I just wanted to thank you for the physics class." He said, "I really enjoyed it. I had a good time in here." I said, "Yeah, and I've enjoyed having you here. You made me go back and relearn some stuff I'd forgotten, and it's been fun having you in the class." He said, "Yeah, I sure wish I could be a scientist. I would like to be a scientist." And I said, "What do you mean, would like to?" He said, "Hey, man, you're brilliant. You got a gift. You got a talent. You need to go into science. We need young people with moral values being scientists. You can't possibly not be a scientist." And he looked at me and said, "No," he said, I don't want to give up my faith." See, somebody had given him the idea that he had to make a choice between science and faith. Somewhere along the line, he had gotten the message from Carl Sagan and others that you have to decide whether you're going to be a well-educated, logical, intelligent, thinking, scientific person or whether you're going to be a stupid, ignorant, religious fanatic. And the idea is there's nothing in between. And what I'm saying to young people today is no, 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 no. You can know why you believe what you believe. You can know there is a God. Science and faith are friends. I came to faith through science. And you can too. And so I started doing this in 1968, trying to show young people. And I didn't think I'd do much of it, but what I found is There's a hunger in young people today. They want to believe in God. They don't want to have the atheistic, destructive philosophy stuffed down their throat, which is what is happening to them, but they have not been given answers. And so most of them are saying, I'm a nun. I don't want to be an atheist, but I don't see any reason to be a Christian. Science and faith are friends. And the best minds that have ever existed have always taken that position. We have a little bi-monthly journal. There's copies on the table out in the lobby. If you'd like to be on our mailing list, there's a on the little circular table, there's a blue sign-up sheet. You can put your name and address on there. We'll add you to our monthly publication list. It's free. There's no cost. And we don't give our mailing list to anybody else. One of the columns we started about 10 years ago was a column called The Nobel Scientist and God. I thought I'd take one or two Nobel scientists who believed in God and show what they said about God. And I really didn't think I would find a lot of material. But you know what? That column's been going now for over 10 years. And I've got another couple of years I've already written. Because virtually all reputable scientists have been believers in God. They haven't all been Christians. But they've all recognized the evidence for God. Einstein was not a Christian. He was born a Jew. But you read his last book, Ideas and Opinions of Albert Einstein, Random Press. By the way, there's bibliographies on the table out there. And you're going to see him saying things like this. And scientists know it's true. The best minds among us have been people who believed in God. And it's important to take the Bible literally. I'm about out of time, so this will have to be my last point. What I mean by taking the Bible literally is not to take some translation that was written centuries ago and perhaps misunderstood the words, but to look at who wrote it, who they wrote it to, why they wrote it, and how the people of the time would have understood it. And what happens in our culture today is that people take an old translation and then they try to find some way to support what they think it ought to say. Let me give you an example, because I just ran across this one. Genesis 6, verse 1, talks about there were giants in the earth in those days. Now, I always had understood from the context that this was not talking about stature. But in the last couple of years, there's been a thing out on the web that shows giant humans in Greece trying to support Genesis 6, saying there were giants in the earth. The Hebrew word Nephilim does not mean giant. It means fallen ones. The reason giant is in the King James translation is that the King James translation was taken from the Vulgate, and for whatever reason, the Pope called Nephilim gigantus in Latin, and the King James people brought it across as giant. But what these people are doing is they're taking these pictures of giant people in the earth. And they're saying, okay, here's the proof that Genesis 6 meant giant. Well, what's just been discovered is that those pictures came from a contest of computer simulation, where you take a computer structure and you manufacture something that isn't real. Some of you may have seen the one that shows the guy climbing the ladder to the helicopter and a great white shark jumps up and tries to grab him. That was one of the winners of that contest. And those giant figures came from that contest. It's not even a photograph. It's a computer simulation. But see, what happens is kids see the picture and they see the claim that it supports the Bible. Then they find out the picture is a fraud. And so they think, well, God must be a fraud. We need to look at who wrote it, why they wrote it, who they wrote it to, and how the people of the time would have understood it. And when you do that, the Bible has no mistakes. It is 100% accurate, 100% perfect. It is the Word of God. Thanks for your attention this morning.